Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is July 31st, 2006, and today's session is entitled Conspiracies and Fantasies, the Code and the Pulse of American Culture. Presented by Mark Burrows, number BUM-2006-01. Let's listen in.
Well, welcome. It's great to have you here. Some of you came on Saturday. I was thought to be here last week by Paul Olson. And so there was a shadow course all week. Some of you may have discovered me off in the woods. I wasn't teaching in the Koinonia, I was in the woods, you know, the secret place. So this is a public version of what I didn't do last week. But welcome to you. I left by the door a handout of an article that I was asked to write a few years ago. It was published in the Christian Century. So if you're interested in some of the historical issues involved in the Da Vinci Code, I at least touch upon them lightly. There's a cottage industry of books. I mean, 45 million people have bought this book by now. Martin, some of my colleagues who are...
Somebody over there passed some this way.
Yeah, are there any more at the door?
No.
Oh, they're gone.
I'll get them. I'll get copies made.
Okay.
There's a cottage industry of books meant to debunk the Da Vinci Code, to debunk the history, to decode the code. For the most part, I'm not going to be spending a lot of time doing that this week. So if you hope that I would be a kind of rabid unraveler of all the problems with Dan Brown's book, you know, see me over coffee and we can talk further, because there are plenty of problems. But what's interested me over the last few years, this book came out in March of 2003. It hit the bookstores in April of 2003, the very month that we began the invasion and occupation of Iraq. What's interested me over the years in talking to many groups, and I have to say, you know, I'm really thankful to Dan Brown, because early church historians, we just don't have an audience. Let's be honest. If I had offered a course on early church history, most of you would be somewhere else right now. So I'm grateful. I mean, for years, I've been going out to churches to do second hours, forums, and so on, and usually it's the same stalwart 15, 10, 15, 20 people come to partake of my brilliance and my humor. But if I'm talking about the Da Vinci Code, they literally come by the hundreds. And I know it's me. So, really grateful to Dan Brown for giving me another vocation. But seriously, you know, we spent the morning, most of us, I think, were here this morning with Barbara Rossing. If you weren't, you missed a great session. I'd encourage you to take those in. And we were thinking about conspiracies, massive conspiracies. And so this morning we're going to get another version of conspiracies. Most of the people who read the Left Behind series don't bother with the Da Vinci Code. I mean, it's kind of an odd publishing phenomenon. The 80 million people who bought those books, for the most part, haven't looked at the Da Vinci Code, because their pastors have told them that it's bunk, that it's leftist propaganda, that it's the devil's work, whatever. I mean, find the variations. And so they're not going to be concerned about it. So this is pulp reading for the left. It's conspiracy for the left. And I think there's good reason why this book really has attained a kind of widespread popularity, which is what mostly has interested me over the last few years of going and talking to groups like you about this book. And usually it's in the coffee time afterwards when people begin to tell me, oh, I knew it wasn't really historically true, but let me tell you how it grabbed me. And so perhaps this week you'll tell us, you'll tell me, or you'll share with each other how this book grabbed you, why it grabbed you, maybe even why it was an important book for you. So as a historian, I don't take it very seriously. It's a kind of alternative retelling, one of many, of early and medieval church history. It's a pretty bad telling of the modern state of Christianity, let's be honest about it. It's a caricature of Roman Catholicism. In fact, I'd say it's a quite anti-Catholic book. And it appeals to Catholics who are either angry at the church or former Catholics who've left the church, who are quite sure the church has been lying to them for a long time. And of course, it came out right at the height in Boston and elsewhere of the pedophilia crisis, where we discovered that in point of fact, the church, the Roman church, has been lying, has been keeping secrets, has been telling lies that have been not just fantasies, but have been deeply injurious to many people, not just boys, but girls, and not just men, but women, particularly women. So there's a moment in our culture that Dan Brown picked beautifully, and I think he really served up a kind of fantasy novel that has captured many of the worries, the angers, the frustrations, and the hungers of our age. So there's something in this book for everybody, really. And whether you liked it or not, you probably found places where you said, oh, that's so right, that's so true. I want to read you just one little passage from the book, and I'm assuming most of you either have read it or you've heard enough of your friends talk about it that you know what the story is, that there's a grand conspiracy launched by the church, by the Christian community, forwarded by Constantine the Emperor, whom Dan Brown locates in the 3rd century, but Dan didn't realize that the 3rd century is the 200s. Constantine lived in the 300s, and that's actually, you know this, that's the, which century?
4th
century, very good. So Constantine in the 4th century, in the 300s, invented this colossal hoax that Jesus was divine, because, as Brown says, nobody in the early centuries believed that. Will come as a surprise to all of you who've read the Gospels. Okay. But anyway, that's the theory that Constantine invented this hoax that Jesus was divine to solidify his own power. And through the ages, the church has kept the secret of the sacred feminine of the goddess under wraps, has hidden it from the majority. And there's this group of people, the Priory of Zion, who've been keeping the secret through the ages. And the grand plot then, the conspiracy thickens with Opus Dei, which is a real group. The Priory of Zion is not. It was a fabricated group. Actually, this is a fascinating story, but somebody smuggled back into the Bibliothèque Nationale in Paris a document, a forgery, which was purported to be the founding documents of the Priory of Zion, and reported this, that they found this in the Bibliothèque Nationale, the National Library in Paris of France. And so that gave it kind of credibility. They found this document. They listed all of these grand masters, including Leonardo. Da Vinci is where he's from, so nobody calls him Da Vinci except Dan. Leonardo. And it would be like saying, I'm Mark of Holden. Of Holden. Of Holden. So, you see me over this weekend, you say, of Holden. Boston. Of Boston. Boston. Anyway, so, you know, Leonardo's in it. Everybody's fascinating. Everybody seems to be in it. You know, you kind of want to wonder who didn't get into this series. Botticelli is in it, and Leonardo is in it. Victor Hugo. Who knew? Victor Hugo is it. So, great. All these great French people. Italians. There's a moment where we hear Brown kind of unraveling where the story, the secrets really come from. It's an interesting passage. There are many interesting passages. Let me say, I mean, it's a book that's full of bunk, but it's also a fascinating book. And it says much about our culture. That's really what I want to talk about this week, and to tell some of the stories that, in point of fact, the church has ignored. And we'll talk about Mary Magdalene at some length, because the church has ignored the central role of Mary Magdalene in the canonical Gospels and in other sources that have been coming to light, discovered over the last years, legitimately discovered over the last years. But here's who's saying it at this point. I think it's Langdon. Yeah, Tom Hanks.
Yeah, some of us only went to the movies.
So you only went to the book. It's pretty close to the book.
Because I was invited to come to a class where a Missouri Synod pastor was going to try and help us.
Yes, help you seek the truth.
Handling this Da Vinci Code fervor.
Yeah.
So I thought I knew I didn't want to read the book. It was a waste of my time. Well, you know, I did go to the movie just so I could kind of
It's a cinematic. It's actually a.
I thought it was one of his work. I like Tom Hanks. Yeah. He's not one of his better movies.
Well, he kept his clothes on, so. The book is really, it's a book made for cinema. It's a book made for cinema. These short, little chapters, none of them more than 3 or 4 pages. Each of them leaves you at a spellbinding moment of almost climax, and then you begin again. So it's a great airplane read. It's a great beach read. It's, you know, it's kind of light reading, and perfect for a movie.
Should have been a miniseries.
Should have been a miniseries. I'd give you a little more time.
The movie wasn't that good.
No, the movie wasn't good. It's gone already in Boston. Yeah. It came and went. Chris Boston, you know. Boston. Well, here it is. The days of the goddess were over. The pendulum had swung. Mother Earth had become a man's world. He's describing what happened under Constantine. And the gods of destruction and war were taking their toll. The male ego had spent 2 millennia running unchecked by its female counterpart. The prior of Zion believed that it was this obliteration of the sacred feminine in modern life that had caused what the Hopi Native Americans called Koyaanisquatzi, life out of balance, an unstable situation marked by testosterone-fueled wars, a plethora of misogynistic societies, women-hating societies, and a growing disrespect for Mother Earth. Robert, Sophie said, her whisper yanking him back to reality. Someone's coming. So there it is. And you know, in a way, that's not a bad description of what keeps some of us at least worried. And what kept us thinking with Barbara Rossing this morning about the kind of hysteria that's fueling so much of the far right wing. And it's not just the Christian right wing, it's the right wing generally. That these wars are necessary things. They're going to clean up the world for the real believers. And that may be real Christian believers, or it may be real political believers, or economic believers. But we'll get rid of all the riffraff. You know, we'll level the playing field. We'll have enough gas for our cars, whether they're small, fuel-efficient cars, or Hummers, SUVs, whatever it might be. We'll clean up the act, and we'll have that 1,000 years of peace where the true believers can really live well. Now, that may seem like a fantasy to you, to us. And I was intrigued when Barbara asked, you know, what are you thinking about? What do you hear about these conspiracies? What do you hear about the Book of Revelation? And many people said, well, not much. You know, in our world, people aren't talking about these things. But they are out there in the wider culture. And there's a huge, huge, eager audience to find someone to blame. To find someone to blame. Someone to cast aside our worries and to give us some solution to the riddles, to the problems of the world we live in. So I think this book really came at a propitious moment. It was an accident, of course, of history, that it happened to have been written and published in the same month that the Iraq War began. I do think, actually, that part of its popularity over the months and years that followed, as it became a bestseller and still on the bestseller list, it's been there now for almost four years, which is quite amazing. Now it's on the paperback bestseller list as well as the hardback bestseller list. But part of it, I think, was that the war happened, that many of us, even who were concerned about the militarism of this current administration, the kind of warmongering that seems to be part of the ideology of our time, not just of the Republican Party, but of the culture we live in, and all of this seemed to come in a moment, I think, that the book came in a moment where it gave us something else to think about. And people who really weren't convinced that this was the true story at least found a distraction. A conspiracy that was, you know, let's face it, kind of a conspiracy light. It wasn't going to change the way most of us who read the book here, and who even may have liked it. I won't ask who liked the book or who liked the movie, but I'm sure some of you did, for different reasons. But part of, I think, of the attraction of this book was it distracted us. And we are, if anything, as Americans, a culture susceptible to distraction and to self-interest.
Yes, ma'am.
to a focus on our own little concerns. This is not a new problem. It's not a modern problem. In fact, I've been rereading de Tocqueville's, Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, written in, do you remember? 1831, published in 1831, after he'd made a visit to the United States, a kind of cultural analysis. It's like reading something a sociologist today would write about religion in America, about the nature of our democracy, which de Tocqueville already felt was largely based on self-interest, on what works for me. Not what works for you, or what works for our society, our culture, but what works for me. That my freedoms, my dignities, are the number one concern in the way that we've structured democracy. That was Tocqueville's criticism 180 years ago, and I suspect it's largely remained true today. So it's a book that came, I think, at a great moment. In another passage in the book, where he is quoting Leonardo from the notebooks, I haven't checked the source. I'm assuming this is accurate. It may not be, but anyway. Many have made a trade of delusions and false miracles, deceiving the stupid multitude. Well, if Leonardo wrote that in the late Middle Ages, it's something that really still rings true for us. Many still make a trade of delusions and false miracles, deceiving the stupid multitudes. And I think, to be honest, we have to admit that often we've been part of a church that has remained largely silent amid the stupid delusions, the delusions and false miracles, and left the multitudes as deceived as they were before we began. I've been amazed in congregations. I'm a pastor, but I teach in a seminary, and I'm out probably two Sundays a month preaching somewhere, teaching about the Da Vinci Code, or something else a little bit more engaging or interesting for me. I can't say that. This is an interesting book. And I'm amazed listening to the liturgies, to the prayers, and to the sermons, how disconnected from the world we live in they often are. And I often know the pastors because they ask me to come. They're often my former students, who are people of great conscience, and they want to be people of equally great courage. But they face congregations that are confused, that are divided, that are worried, and that are frustrated. And so it's not, and my wife is a pastor, so I understand this. It's not an easy thing to name the truths in a time like ours, either from the pulpit or even in conversations in our congregations. There's just so much reality that we can bear. And I think right now we're in a place of a kind of unbearable sense of burden. Holden is a kind of microcosm that you sit down at a table and within 2 minutes you're talking about global warming and the crises facing us in our times. It's a good thing that we talk about those things here. It's probably easier to talk about them here. More people, we're at least assume, are concerned about these things at Holden Village. We may have different views, but we at least locate the problems in largely the same ways. But most of us don't know enough, really, to understand the magnitude of the crisis facing us. And if we did, it would leave us sleepless at night. And so books like this really are, they're kind of a wonderful distraction for us. And they give us something else to think about and worry about. And underneath all of that, despite, I think, the overwhelming fantasy of this novel, there are enough moments where Brown identifies our fears that keep us going and that connect us, even when we say, I don't like the book, I didn't like the movie, I didn't like the book. But we keep coming back to it because it brings us to the place of our worries. And these are very real and even important worries. Let me name a couple of them. Maybe you have others, but a couple of them that have been prominent to me in speaking with groups formally and informally over the last 3 years. Frustration with the institutional church. This is a book that tells us the story that the institutional church has been lying for 2,000 years, has been deceiving us, has been manipulating us, has kept women out of power, has kept the truth under wraps, has been about cultivating its own privileges. And we know enough about the church, however we define that, whether it's our denomination, our sense of the Roman Catholic Church and its long history, Opus Dei, which is a real group, which does have some issues to be truly concerned about, and other issues of remarkable generosity and goodness. I can talk about that later if you wish. But we know enough about the churches, the way the church has frustrated us, has let us down, that when we read a book like this, it taps into that. And we know with Dan Brown that he's onto at least something there. Frustrated with the institutional church. Frustrated with the banal nature of religion in our day. Maybe it's not your religion. Maybe you're happy to be ELCA or United Presbyterian, UCC, that's my tribe, whatever you are. But you look around at religion in the States or in the world and you say, my God, it's out of control. And religion has become a dangerous force of destruction and of violence in our world. That's not new, but that's certainly true and evident for all of us today. Or maybe you think that religion is just out of touch with a really, truly marvelous world of God. And again, this is not a new experience for us. Already the great sociologist, the inventor of sociology, Max Weber, talked about how modern culture has entered a disenchanted age. We've lost the enchantment of earlier societies in which spiritual things were believed more readily, or at least so we think, where the mysterious, the esoteric, the hidden, was given more credence than today. I talked a bit about that on Saturday. So maybe you're frustrated with that. Maybe you're frustrated with a church that has kept women silent for most of its history. It's hard. I'm a historian, so it's easier for me to think about the scope of this. But there are still the majority of Christian communities today, and it's becoming a bigger majority, offer women no voice. We think, oh, things have changed. Now women have a voice. Women can be pastors in our churches. Women can even be
bishops.
Women can even be presiding bishops, archbishops, perhaps. Who knows? But in most Christian communities, and this is statistically true, in most Christian communities, that's not true. And it's not going to be true. And the overwhelming movement, as one sees the proliferation, the expansion of Christianity on the global scene, so we're really a minority. The progressive, mainline progressive Christian movement is a decreasing minority in this culture and worldwide. So by the year 2050, the nature of Christianity will be defined largely in the Southern Hemisphere, largely by people who've had no critical education, whether theological or other, and who think about the world through the lens of a quite literal, quite straightforward reading of the Bible, whether it's the book of Revelation, or whether it's the Pauline letters and Paul's strictures against women, or whether it's other parts of the scriptures. We have to take that very seriously, that we may think that now we're in an enlightened Christian age, but the tide has shifted. And the very frustrations that have been, in some sense, a residue underneath all of our experience are growing in the world of contemporary Christianity today. That's just a fact. That's not a fantasy, that's a fact. So if we're frustrated with the way the church has dealt through the ages with women in positions of authority, it's actually getting worse. It's actually not getting better. The first church to ordain a woman was a little congregation, my tribe, a Congregationalist church in New York State. We didn't have to go to the synod because they didn't have a synod. They didn't have to go to the General Assembly because there was no General Assembly. They simply knew that one of their women was called by God, despite the overwhelming witness of the Bible, a woman named Antoinette Brown, and they ordained her. And there were many Christians around them who said, this is the end.
And when was that?
This is about 1853, I think. 1853, yeah. So she was ordained by a congregation, not by a denomination. The Congregationalists eventually did ordain a woman as a denomination, that is, as a group, began to affirm women's ministry about 40 years later. So we take things, I think, sometimes too quickly for granted if we assume that somehow because we've made these gains, because we've made these strides forward, that the problem is settled. So I think Dan Brown's book actually touches a chord there, probably the most vibrant one, at least in my experience, has been among women who've really been peed off at what the church has done to them. Particularly older women who felt a call to ministry or priesthood, who were never given the chance, never had the moment of opening, where somebody said, your value, your voice, your authority is important for us. And so they've gotten toward the middle or end of their life, it's too late for them to find an official way into the church, and they've either left the church angry, or they began to form alternative forms of Christian community, of Christian leadership and Christian community. Woman Church, which was thriving in the 1970s and 80s, is really on the way. It's a movement in the Catholic Church to begin to ordain women on their own and create communities of women and open-minded men to create a different kind of church. And that's really, really dying out. So frustrations and fears. The fears of the, I think most of us here probably aren't concerned about the grand conspiracies of the church as Brown portrays them. Maybe you are. There's some, I think, some credibility to some of the things Brown talks about, enough to keep even informed readers turning the pages and wondering what's next. We know enough about the church's history to have some valid concerns about it all. But I think the fear is much, much bigger than that, and Brown touches on it in an astute way by mentioning the pedophilia crisis, by talking about the testosterone-driven wars, these male-driven wars that seem to be threatening our very survival. There are enough points, I think, in the book that touch on something we know to be true and very real and very worrisome. And actually, if some of you who are here this morning could honestly say that, you know, you're not around people reading the book of Revelation as literal truth, as a story of the end times, you probably are around people who get a hold of the Da Vinci Code and begin to see things there that they can identify as a what seems to be a conspiracy of enormous threat to the very existence of humankind. So there's something in this book, I think, for everybody. And part of it is, I think, just fascination. Here's a retelling of a story that all of us here know quite well, the Jesus story, but with all kinds of twists. And of course, we don't really have much of a story about Jesus in the canonical Gospels. There's not much there. I mean, if you took your whole life, even if you died at 33, and tried to put it into 16 chapters, would that be adequate? Even if you've had a dull life. Maybe you've had a dull life. But just identifying where you've lived and who you've known, who your friends were, your disciples if you had some, or who were your mentors, even that would take probably 16 chapters, right? So we know that there's a lot more to the story than we find out about in the Gospels. And for most of the church's history, I'll talk about this tomorrow and Wednesday, for most of the church's history, the role of the preacher wasn't really to read the literal Bible, the literal words of Scripture. It was to embellish. It was to expand the story. A preacher was a fictional role. It was making the story bigger, making it more real, making it connect with your life, with your issues, with our issues, the concerns of the time. That's how preachers understood their role. They didn't worry about whether they were literally following the gospel stories. They didn't understand that to be their vocation. Their vocation was to animate the story. Just the same, you know, when you go to family reunions, right? You all do this. Most of you? Great. You think about family reunions are a great place to understand how history happens, right? If you remember the stories you heard as a child at the family reunions you went to, the chances are nobody had them written down, so the next time you gathered, someone would read them, right? And offer a sermon on them. And interpret it. No! You retell them, and over the years, they become different stories. Why? Well, maybe because you have lying relatives. They're not Lutherans, you know? They're UCCs or something, I don't know. But maybe it's because that's the nature of remembering. And we remember things to make sense to people. If you're telling someone a story and you're looking at them and you're not reading it from a book, if you're looking at them, you know the moment their eyes glaze over that you've lost them, you know? And what do you do at that point?
You make it more dramatic.
Well, can you make it more dramatic?
Stop.
Or?
Go away.
What?
Or go away. Stop.
Or you change.
Or you change. Or you change the way you're telling it. You try to figure out what people can relate to, what they do understand. What they do know about.
You got a left behind.
Yeah.
I was just going to comment that I think that's what Dan Brown is doing with the story.
Yeah.
The interpretations of the story, which
yeah.
we believe. I mean, it's almost, he's taking the definition of what you just said, a preacher back then, trying to think about. He wasn't taking the literal interpretation
Absolutely.
Of the story that we were reading. He was keeping us interested in the story.
Absolutely.
Because there was parts of the story, of course, I was like, oh, okay, that was kind of weird. I mean, I've read it a couple times. But it kept me interested, and actually I'll admit that I really do want to go to the Last Supper now and see
mm-hmm.
how he got that interpretation, which he portrayed in the book. Because,
yeah, the
well,
painting you're talking
the painting,
about.
Yeah. Because while it may not be accurate in my mind as a Christian, you know, maybe it is accurate in the mind of book, depending
yeah.
on the book.
Yeah.
I mean, because literally Dan Brown is taking a story and just giving it to us, you know, and it's up for interpretation of what you want to believe. I mean, you know, some of it was, the way he portrayed it was very believable.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I'll admit that.
Yeah.
But the way he used some of the theories and connected them kind of made it disjointed and as far as, but it did make me think about
yeah.
it, and I think that's what his purpose was. It
Good
wasn't
point.
To say, okay, you should take this as the Bible and use it now. It's not.
Yeah.
That wasn't his purpose at all.
That's well said. I think what Brown has done is to retell a story that, after all, we all know. And we know it in the kind of bare skeletal structure that we preach on and read in the Bible week after week. Some of us have been reading other sources. I notice even some of you around here probably have read some of the Gnostic Gospels. Did you read the Gospel of Judas?
What are the Gnostic Gospels?
I'll get to that later in the week, but yeah, I'll come back to it. The Gnostic stories, they're called Gnostic Gospels, are stories circulating in the early church, probably in the late first, early second century already, although the manuscripts we have are later than that, but they go back to an earlier source.
Okay.
They tell the story of Jesus differently. The Gospel of Judas, any of you, the big, you know, it was out on the, you could get it on the web, you can download it from a National Geographic site, which published it in one of its volumes earlier in the year. Fascinating story, kind of resuscitating Judas. It's an ancient text. One of these texts discovered that finally has been put back together. It was badly, these texts were papyrus manuscripts, papyrus texts that had been discovered in 1945. By a poor farmer in southern Egypt who was digging for nitrates to fertilize his field. And he hit this earthenware vessel, which was full of these papyrus ancient manuscripts. He didn't know what they were. They were written in Coptic, but they were a Coptic he couldn't read. Probably was an illiterate peasant. Muhammad Ali was his name, not the boxer. His name is Muhammad Ali. And they sat in his house for a few years. His mother would use them to start the fire. She'd tear off a few pages and start. So someone we lost to fire starting. And then they just crumbled. They were literally in thousands of pieces. So scholars have been painstakingly trying to put these pieces back together and bit by bit publishing them, including most recently the Gospel of Judas, which resuscitates not Mary Magdalene, but Judas, who is a good guy, who becomes the fall guy in the stories of the Gospels, but who is a necessary character in the story. You can't have Jesus crucified without Judas, and so this is a positive telling of Judas. So anyway, retellings of the story have existed from the earliest centuries. And I would say, as a historian, we have to read our Gospels more in this way. And I don't mean to be disrespectful to the authority of the Bible, no. It's story that mattered to early Christians. Not history. They didn't know what history was. That's a modern thing. The sense of eyewitness history. No, history is more like what happens in a family reunion, where generation by generation, the stories are told, and they're obviously going to be embellished to tell the truth of the story. What's the truth of the story? It's not necessarily exactly what happened. It's the characters involved. If I want to tell you about my grandfather, who is a great character in my life, died far too young, but a great character in my life, I don't have any written evidence of what my grandfather said, but I can tell you what he said. I can tell you stories he told me as a boy. I can tell you about the first time he took me to Wrigley Park to watch my first professional baseball game. I remember every moment of that afternoon. They didn't have lights back then, remember? Chicago, Wrigley Park, last lighted stadium. So is it true? Probably not. Probably most of it is invented in my aging adult mind. But it tells the story of my grandfather that I don't know any other way to tell. Now, it's not to say that the Gospels are sort of fantasy and fiction in a perverse sense. It is to say that these were stories that circulated orally in communities for generations before they were written down. In the same way that probably, if you realize that none of the young people are coming anymore to the family reunions, and that may happen, that they just aren't interested, they don't have time to take a week of their life and to go all the way out to some remote town in South Dakota and hang out with these old geezers, us, you know, and drink root beer, don't help them, and tell the stories that aren't interesting anymore. If they stop coming, you may find yourself doing what many do, and that's they're writing them down, writing down the stories. It's amazing. We're doing, in a sense, what the early Christians were doing, writing them down so that, well, not our children, they're not interested, but their children might be interested, and we want them to know what the stories were. My father's taping reminiscences, which are wonderful, of his childhood that he doesn't want to lose, and then maybe you have family members going to. The Gospels were ways of, at a certain point, writing them down because they needed to be written, because the community could no longer remember directly. There was no one alive anymore who could tell the story because they were there. So they began to write them down to capture as much of the truth of the story as they could tell. It's one reason why, the discrepancies between the Gospels have never really bothered me as a historian. They fascinate me because what you start to see is how different communities were telling the same story quite differently to meet the needs of their communities, just the way we do it today. So this doesn't unnerve me. Oh my God, where's the real history? This is history happening. This is the way history is made. And it's why I have the best job in the world, because I deal with truth and fiction, and we can't tell one from the other. They're always woven together. Yeah.
I was just going to mention that, you know, a few years ago, Walter Landgren wrote the Book of God, you know, the Bible in novel form. And it really made it readable. You could sit down and read the Bible right through.
Absolutely.
And did a lot of poetic
embellishing.
Embellishing.
And I mean, that's the point, that the Bible wasn't a single book. Biblia, books. There were so many books that were written by myriad generations. So there's no coherence. So when someone like Walter Wenger gets a hold of it, a brilliant storyteller, and tells a story from one vantage point, it starts to make sense.
And he kind of went back in time and wrote it like the history was during that time.
Right.
So the Christmas story isn't Disney-ized or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
We do a fun thing with this with our new member class.
Uh-huh.
And we have pie set out. The new member, there's food every night of new member class, but it's a 6-week course, and when we're going to get into scripture, one of my colleagues and I are there, and I come down late, and she's got pie set up, and I said, this pie isn't for tonight. We get into an argument. I said, it's for the group down the hall, and we can't have this. We get into an argument that's not like us.
Publicly, in front of everybody.
Yes, in front of everybody, and they're kind of sitting there like they're like, oh my gosh, maybe this isn't the church for us.
Where's the pie?
And she said, well, if we'd ever communicate during the day, and you know, and finally, the cue is I go like this, and she takes a pie and smacks it in my face. I mean, the first time she did it was I had peaches coming out my nose. Well, anyway,
this is a church for me.
Well, they just sit there like, oh my Lord, what's happened? And it's good. But anyway, I said, I'm okay. I'm going to go clean up. write about what you just saw in your journals that they got the first night.
Oh.
Well, they write it, and I come back and say, share at your tables what you just wrote, blah, blah, blah. We get into it, and well, the moral of the story is, did any of you write the same thing?
No.
They didn't.
Right.
And I said, that's weird. You just all saw the same thing.
Yeah.
Is anybody right? Is anybody wrong?
Yeah.
And it's our way of getting into scripture that,
wonderful,
like Matthew, Mark, Luke, did any, is one of them right? Is one of them wrong? They saw the same stuff, and
yeah,
a wonderful lead into scripture of...
Well, you've
I've hit a lot of pies in my face, but it seems to work.
People come now to join your church just to see the pie.
Word's gotten out yet. It may, and we may have to change the story.
I really want to ask that question throughout this week, and I won't ask the question, is this book true? Because actually, for the most part, it isn't true, but... It speaks truths to us, and that's really what I want to get at this week. To talk
but it's
about,
a novel, right?
It's a novel, but
it's in the fiction section.
It's in the fiction section, but it's a different kind of a novel than a even than historical fiction. Historical fiction recreates a period. This isn't recreating a period. It's unraveling a mystery, and it's unraveling a conspiracy, and it's telling a story that purports to be the true story that's been hidden. So while it is a novel on one level, it gets us at a different level. Because it makes us think about, well, what is the truth of the story? Yeah, Candy.
The Missouri Synod Lutheran pastor that I was at a book group with, he really wanted to believe that Dan Brown believed that this was historically true.
Yeah.
Now, in your critique of it, would you say that Dan Brown deliberately set out to deceive?
I think every time Dan Brown goes to the bank,
he's happy.
He's very happy to say, this is the real story.
Yeah.
And if you go on Dan Brown's website, he will say that this is the real story.
Okay, well, that's what I was trying to help this pastor, because he was very concerned that this man had violated rights of producing a historical novel, because if it wasn't based on true historical fact, how could it be considered a historical novel?
Yeah.
Well, I kept telling him, it's not a historical novel, it's simply a novel.
It's a
and
novel.
People can write anything they want
sure.
in a novel, because if it sells,
that's
you
right.
go
but
to
it,
the
it's,
bank.
It's an odd genre. It's not a historical novel, but it's a novel that is rooted in a retelling of history. And it's retelling, I think the reason it interests us, even if we don't buy it all or don't buy any much of it, it's a story we know in one version or in some versions. And this is such a radically different telling of the story that touches on enough of our worries and angers and frustrations and concerns that it keeps us going, that it draws us in.
The thing he was so upset about was that he felt the book really attacked his world.
Yeah, well, some people do. And I would say the people who are reading the Left Behind series are going to churches where their pastors are going to be offering debunking the code, you know, and sort of all of the factual errors. And I have to say, my first read-through as a historian, that's what I noticed as well. All of these just rampant mistakes or wild, fantastic readings of stories purported as just true, as true tellings of the story. And this is one very engaged retelling of the story. It's not the only one.
No.
And what I discover, actually, when I preach a sermon in a congregation, especially if it's not my church where people are too nice to me, you know, they won't really tell me what they're thinking because they like me. I'm a likable guy. But if I show up somewhere and preach a sermon, and I linger for the coffee hour, and begin to, and people will come, the few who really want to tell me what they thought I was saying, I discover that they actually didn't hear my sermon at all. They heard the sermon that they needed to hear. And it may have been one word, one image, one story that launched them on a whole train of thinking. It's very humbling and good for pastors to know this. That in point of fact, you don't preach one sermon. You say, you read one text, or you speak one story, but remember the old folk song, a man, he hears what he wants to hear and disregards the rest. Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. A man, he hears what he wants to hear. A woman, she hears what she wants to hear and disregards. There's something truthful about that in human experience. It's not a conservative issue. Let me be quick to say that. It's as liberal as conservative. It's red and blue state. It's this and that. It's human. It's human nature. Yeah.
Paul Simon.
Yeah. Oh, Paul Simon wrote it. There you go. Thank you.
Tim O'Brien talks about, he writes his novels about the Vietnam War.
Oh, yeah.
Is story truth and happening truth? And that his stories are not about the happening truth.
Yeah.
They're about what happened to people.
Oh, yeah.
Over there. What happened to him. It's the story truth that he's after.
He's an amazing, one of the best writers,
yeah.
I think, on war we have.
Yeah, he is. And that also happens when the text is freed from the author's hand and it's in the reader.
Yeah.
Then the reader also brings story truth
of
based
course.
On their own experience.
Of course.
And so really reading is about that story truth. It's about
yeah.
what we need to get
well
at
said.
That moment.
The story truth. That's well that's a beautiful phrase.
Story truth.
And Tim O'Brien, those of you who don't know his writing, one of the I think the best writers on the moral complexities of war. The Things They Carried With Them, is that the name of the novel?
The Things They Carried.
The Things They Carried. An amazing story which begins with an account of Tim O'Brien of what an infantryman or woman carried on their bodies, and what it weighed, what it was used for. And then what you discover as the novel unfolds is what they had to carry to survive. Not just these weapons, but their own fantasies, their own hopes, their illusions, whatever it was that could keep them alive. So story truth, that's beautifully said. Really, what Dan Brown is helping us think about is story truth. It's not history truth, even though I think it pretends to be or assumes to be history truth. And that's what keeps conservatives buying it, because they're angry that it's telling the wrong history. That's what keeps others, I think, buying it, because it tells a story that does connect with enough of our story truth that we don't care if this is all correct. But there's something in it that keeps us reading. Yeah.
Yeah, you could say the same thing, I guess, in coming to say the Genesis story.
Yeah.
That obviously we can attempt to read it as historical truth, as historical fact, and somewhere at the core of it, there is a landscape that that people had experienced.
Yeah.
There was some kind of experience that formed the core of that story.
Yeah.
But Deep Desire Regenesis, I read it as, in a sense, as poetry. I mean, what
yeah.
speaks to me in the Genesis story are those symbols, are those images, which have profound truth in them for us still.
Yeah.
And I think over and over again, that's what we go back to.
Right. Story truth is poetic truth. It's
yeah.
it's the truth that's true even if it didn't happen in quite that way, right? And if you could replay that afternoon I spent with my grandfather driving like a hellion, as I remember, to get to the ballpark in time, Wrigley Field, in his old, well, it wasn't old then, but in this VW bug. And he was not a man of many words. But I can remember the conversations we had. I remember him watching people leave in the eighth inning because the Cubs were down 5-2. And when they rallied in the ninth inning, I remember him telling me, all those people out on the Dan Ryan Expressway, they're listening to the radios, they wish they were here. They're not real Cub fans. I don't know if he actually said that. And chances are, if you ran the tape, he didn't say it. But that was my grandfather, and that was the poetic story, the story truth of my grandfather. So what we're going to do this week is really find out about the story truth of Christianity, of Christianities. As I teach my classes, there isn't a story of early Christianity. There are stories of early Christianities, plural. And the diversity of views, which are both in our Bible, ensconced in that text we call too comfortably the New Testament, and in many other tellings of the story, both texts that purport to be original tellings of the Jesus story and interpretations through the ages. I get to spend my life really with these story truths. It's an incredibly great vocation, because in a way, what we discover as we move to poetic truth, to story truth, is that the issues that seem to burden the kind of culture wars right now in our society are really not the right questions. We're not asking the right questions.
Amen.
But there are different questions we need to ask. And to me at least, and Paul, is Paul here from Paul the preacher yesterday? No? Great, great. Think about imagination, about what our imaginations are really doing. This week is going to be on on a cultivating a kind of vivid imagination, and I hope a faithful imagination, which means we're going to have to tell more of the story than we have in the Bible we get from week to week. And we're going to have to tell different stories. We're going to have to add stories to tell the truth, even of the Jesus story or of the Jesus stories. We're going to have to add truths. We're going to have to find, as we do in those family reunions, we're going to have to find ways to embellish the stories, to add new stories, to get to the old truth that we remember in any way we can to keep that story alive. And that really is what the nature of Christian communities is. It's finding any way we can to keep the faithful truth of the story alive. A truth that will contradict us. Yes, Chesterton, one of his many brilliant bon mots, that the story every society needs, Christian society needs, is the one that contradicts it the most. G.K. Chesterton. So part of our storytelling as Christians is going to have to be cultivating the courage to tell a story that contradicts even us liberals, if we're liberals. The story that will contradict our blindnesses, the things that we refuse to see. A man, a woman, she sees what she wants to see and disregards the rest. What are we disregarding? I think Brown has forced us to regard parts of the story that we've disregarded. Maybe not parts of the history, but parts of the story truth, as you said. Parts of the poetic truth, as Doug has said. Parts of the literary truth. Not the literal truth, but the storied truth carried through the ages. Yeah, Dan.
To link this to Barbara's comments this morning, she challenged, invited us to speak a story truth,
yes,
in response to the left behind camp or,
yeah,
the, you know, perspective,
yeah,
on what the end is. And she challenges us to, and invites us to think that it is an end time.
Yeah.
And to, for us then to speak out in our forums.
Absolutely agree.
In our social, I think of my neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know, and not my church members necessarily.
That's right. Well, that's why, you know, in a way, it does concern me that in so much of our liturgy and in so much of our preaching, or at least the preaching that I hear, and some of it that I do myself, we seem so manifestly out of touch, mm-hmm, with the crisis we're living through.
Yeah.
And it's partly because we don't know how to do it, how to handle it. It's so enormous, so overwhelming, that, well, maybe that hour in church can just give us some good old-time religion, whatever that looks like for you. Maybe it's good old-time liberal religion, and let's be honest about that. We have our version of avoidance, of talking about these issues, and going back to our life as if really nothing mattered, nothing changed. So I think that's the story we need to look at ourselves. We need to put that mirror up to ourselves as much as we can. Yeah. Here in the front and then Doug in the back. Yeah.
Marcus Borg refers to this often as the more than literal truth.
Yeah.
And the Jesus, which we then as a community invent, is called the post-Easter Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the more than literal truth. Sure. The gospel writers themselves were telling the more than literal truth. Even in their culture, they knew this was an unbelievable story, a believable story, but not a factual story. It was a more than literal story. And again, the disciples, that wonderful text that is the theme for this year, remember the end of Matthew's gospel, we'll hear about it tonight again, in the Vespers. Many believed, but some doubted. Many believed, but some doubted. And it's the some who doubt that I think are often the ones we don't really attend to in our churches. We wish they would just get with the program. And maybe they need to get with the program, but maybe the program that we're telling doesn't get to the story truth that they really desperately need to hear. A truth that goes perhaps against the grain of our own presumptions and predilections, our desires, our habits. Yeah.
And this may be obvious, but as a sometime English teacher, this is all about the understanding of how fiction works.
Yes.
And I think with high school kids, for instance, there's a general bafflement as to, you know, fiction is not true and history is true, and so there was this idea of group writing where kids would write a fictional story, and the truest things of their heart would all be poured into this story, and at the end of it, they would realize how fiction works. That,
yeah.
That it was this, it was the story, and you find this in many writers, this description of what they're trying to do with their fiction, which is to explore the truth long enough to get at the truth that is mm-hmm. is above and beyond.
Yeah, the truth behind the truth.
Mm-hmm. The, sure. the facts, yep. the telling of the story as they're hearing it.
Remember the novel of Dickens, Hard Times,
mm-hmm.
Grad Grind? That's one of the characters, Grad Grind. What a great name. Grad Grind, who just wants the facts. You know, nothing but the facts. Give me the facts. And we all know that the facts won't keep us alive. I mean, in these days, I mean that quite literally. The facts won't keep us alive. If we just know the crisis we're in, but aren't doing anything to imagine another way, we're in trouble. And it doesn't matter if we're on the far right or the far left. This is my point, because most of us here, maybe all of us, are not on the far right. So let's not go after the bogeyman who isn't here. On the far left, the fictions that we continue to cultivate that leave us inert, unable to move, unable to think, unable to act, those are the ones that concern me. Because in point of fact, I'm not actually talking to people who are worried about the revelation, who are reading the book of Revelation. We should know about this. It's not to discount attending to this. But those are not my tribe. They're not my people. They're not looking. They're looking at other conspiracies. They're worried about other scenarios, and they're desperate for a different story truth, to use your vivid image. It's telling that story truth that we need to be about. And strangely, I think Dan Brown has done us a favor by giving us a novel that tells such a strong version, not a weak version, a strong version of the story truth. The story truth, not the history. The story truth. That it ought to compel us to come up with something as riveting, something as captivating, and something as something more truthful, let's be honest, than this. So by the end of the week, I hope we'll have a chance to kind of think through this and at least come up with some alternative stories. Doug, I don't think you got it back in.
Yeah, and maybe it's been said, but I feel like perhaps our tendency...
Can you all hear upstairs?
No, I think that our tendency at times... within a liberal context, is to not fully convey that, in fact, we do have a core truth.
Yeah.
Our tendency is to say, well, of course, this is a possible interpretation, this is a possible... I mean, there's a kind of open-mindedness, which is a beautiful thing. But I know that it's very important that I have to try to convey the fact that while I don't have to read literally in terms of the gospel, what I do experience is that there is a core truth
yeah.
that is revelatory, that is transformative,
yeah.
and that invites me to totally change my life according to what I am experiencing.
Yeah, and that it's that core truth I hope we can get at.
Yeah.
That's the heart of it. The core truth that will call me to convert more deeply to the way of Jesus. To the core truth that will call me to, not you. Actually, I don't think Jesus was much concerned about converting anybody else than the one person he was looking at, who had a who had no hope, who had no courage to live. And it's why Jesus spent most of his time among those who were the left behind. Right? Actually, the Gospels are the left behind stories. They're good news for the people left behind. They are. They're actually good news for the people who are left behind. Tim LaHaye will not tell us that, but that's what the Gospels are about. So we need to attend to the left-behind Gospels for people like us as well, and the people we know who really are struggling to find some core truth that can create a more habitable culture and world to live in. We're almost at the end of our time, so short one.
I was just going to say that I think the text Dan Brown presents us with gives us the opportunity to question it, and the more questions we ask, whether
directly related to our faith and what we've read, allow us to compound and confirm our beliefs? And isn't confirming our question something that we do to become stronger in our faith? I mean, it gives us the opportunity, it gives us the chance to do it in a modern day and connect these old texts, because...
Well spoken. That's really what the whole point of this week and these classes is going to be, so thank you for that. I want to close with one more reading from, supposedly from Leonardo.
His wife did the research, though, right?
Blinding ignorance does mislead us. Oh, wretched mortals, open your eyes. Blinding ignorance does mislead us. Oh, wretched mortals, open your eyes. I hope this week will not simply be a journey of interesting conversation together, but that we'll learn how to open our eyes to the real crises that do face us, and to look for the conversion that we need and that our world needs desperately at this point. So thanks, and see you when I do. Again.